thank you all for bearing with us, or bearing with me, and as we try to get the technology working. Unfortunately, Josh Kalancic, who was supposed to join us via Skype, is we're unable to connect on spec right now. But in the interest of time, I want to get us started, and one of my staff members will try to reach him by phone, and we'll plug him in at that point. If we do, are able to get him online and talk to them then. So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the executive director here at the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 think tank focused on Taiwan policy research and analysis. Our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion on Taiwan policy here in the United States and around the world. Thank you all for joining us today for our first public seminar after we celebrated our one-year anniversary last month on September 14th. We capped it off with our inaugural annual symposium on upgrading U.S.-Taiwan relations in the 21st century. We had over 120 participants. The audio and video recording, which featured keynotes by Representative Ron DeSantis from Florida, AIT Managing Director John Norris, and Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense Dave Helvey, are all available on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. If you're not already signed up to receive our updates, you may do so on our website so you can receive the latest news. You may have also noticed a new type of event in our repertoire. We held our first movie night at GTI a week ago in cooperation with the Taiwan Academy, in which we featured Connection by Fate, a film about Taiwanese people's struggle to find their identity in post-martial law period through the eyes of a cab driver. While our function is first and foremost that of a think tank, we plan to organize more cultural programs in the future to help raise awareness about Taiwan's rich and diverse culture. So please stay tuned for more programmings in that regard. Before I begin today's program, I also want to thank our co-founders, board of directors, and advisors, some of whom are in the room today, for their continued support, and also the staff and intern for their hard work. The topic of today's panel is on authoritarian influence, democratization, and Taiwan's role. As we scroll through the international headlines, it's not hard to find evidence that authoritarian influence is on the rise. This was made abundantly clear in the recent meddling in the U.S. presidential election, which U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations described as warfare. Countries like France, as well as Ukraine, Georgia, and other nations in the post-Soviet space have long felt the brunt of Russian political warfare and influence operations. Such activities can involve, but it's not limited to, political meddling, propaganda, infiltration of political parties, NGOs, and businesses. Yet, Russia is not the only authoritarian government that is engaged in such operations. There's also China. Recent cases in New Zealand, Australia, the Czech Republic represent cases in which China's influence operations are affecting those democracies. Perhaps more troubling is that at the same time that authoritarian influence appears on the rise, democracy seems to be on retreat. Whether there is a causal effect between the rise of authoritarian influence and democratic recession, I'll leave that to our panel of experts. But it stands to reason that just as other democracies were instrumental in applying pressure on Western authoritarian governments to liberalize, support by other authoritarian governments can help leaders resist the people's calls for liberalization. Given the economic rise of some authoritarian governments, the scale of such influence is perhaps unprecedented. As Najeeb Noorland of the National Bureau of Asian Research wrote in her report on the PRC's Belt and Road Initiative, with BRI, China has now assumed the lead in promoting Eurasian integration. Promoting regional developments is seen not as a way to encourage political liberalization, but to the contrary, as a means of strengthening and stabilizing existing authoritarian regimes around China. Case in point within Asia is what is happening now in Cambodia, in which the ruling government has arrested and charged the leader of the largest opposition party with treason for alleged conspiracy with the United States to topple the government. International efforts underway to call for the release of imprisoned opposition leader Kem Sokha are stymied by the lack of concern and also Beijing's support for Prime Minister Hun Sen. Another case is a horrendous backslide in the protection of rights for a specific segment of the population in Burma, which is leading the United Nations to describe the violence perpetrated against the Muslim Rohingyas, a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Then Assistant Secretary of State Danny Russell noted in 2005, quote, that there's a lot that Burma can learn from Taiwan, end quote. Adding that many, that Taiwan's example may serve as an inspiration for many young people in Myanmar. Indeed, Taiwan's democratization experience could serve as a valuable example for many countries in the region with comparable political and economic conditions to Taiwan that are attempting to make a transition to a freer and open political system. Perhaps a more concerted effort to apply these experiences from Taiwan could help forestall or at least to not make similar mistakes, or even so to prevent the occurrences that we are witnessing throughout the world today. Having emerged as a full-fledged democracy from the shackles of martial law, its ongoing efforts internally to deal with political reconciliation over 228, and also three peaceful transfers of power between the political parties, there is much experiences to learn from. So we're very pleased to have assembled a great group of experts here today who have not only studied the issues extensively, but also practice it both in government and non-governmental organizations. To my immediate left is Louisa Cohen-Grave. Louisa has worked on Asian political developments for 3 decades while working at the National Endowment for Democracy as Director for East Asia, and previously as Senior Program Officer and Program Officer. She developed NED's small grants program for East Asia, new program, which includes new programs for North Korea, Mongolia, Cambodia, Malaysia, Vietnam, Hong Kong, and China, including support for Tibetan and Uyghur human rights. To her left, we have Ambassador Mark Ligon. Ambassador Ligon is Chief Policy Officer at Friends of the Global Fights Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. He's Distinguished Senior Scholar at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. In the NGO world, he served as President of Freedom House. In the executive branch, he served in 3 successive roles at the State Department of State, member of the Secretary of State's Policy Planning Staff, Deputy Assistant Secretary of International Organization Affairs, and finally, Ambassador at Large, directing the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. Now, I will just briefly introduce Josh and with the hopes that we will be able to get him online. Oh, really? Okay, good. Okay, so we'll try to get him online, but I will just briefly introduce him in the hopes that he will be online to talk to us. But Josh is Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was previously a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He studies China's relations with Southeast Asia, including Chinese investments, aid, and diplomacy. Now, the format for our discussion today will keep with previous public seminars, where I'll present a series of questions, directed questions to the speakers, as well as communal questions, well, I'll ask for the speakers to respond to as a group, or each individually to respond to them. So to kick us off, I'd like to start with you, Ambassador Ligon. You know, when you were the head of Freedom House, you had to look at the big picture all the time. The Freedom of the World Report is the only study that I'm aware of that that systematically monitors the program, the progress and regression of freedom worldwide. What is your assessment on the current state of freedom in the world? Is authoritarianism really on the march and democracy in retreat? And more importantly, what do you think contributed to this kind of thing?
Well, Freedom House's research definitely reinforces the conclusion that there is retrogression in democracy. And then a unique thing about Freedom House is that it looks at the relationship between great powers and form of government. And of course, Russia and China are sharing models for controlling the media, cowing civil society, and so on. But it is true that what Samuel Huntington called the third wave of democratization in the world is having an ebb. I wouldn't say it's plummeting, it's definitely having an ebb. And the pattern is leading authoritarian countries sharing methods or being a model to countries to copy. States around the world that are ostensibly democracies backtracking. And then a problem at home in the West, in the core of the democratic world, with democratic institutions. Why? Well, the patterns Freedom House has noted, and I think others have too, have been corruption, diminution of freedom of assembly, problems with freedom of expression, the free press, and in particular, also noted in Freedom House's Freedom of the Net report, as well as the Freedom of the World report, that social media have become an avenue of authoritarian control, not only the universal solvent that washes away authoritarians with free expression.
Louisa, you worked at AMD. I mean, the purpose of the AMD is there essentially to promote democratization. And as the head of the Asia shop there, I mean, your job was to promote democracy in Asia. So can you tell us essentially, you know, how did NAB promote democratization, and what were the major challenges?
Absolutely. Another way of putting it is not so much democracy promotion, but rather democracy assistance. So the way democracy comes about is not because international friends of democracy bring it to a particular country. It's because the people in the country, the Democrats there, fight for democracy and bring it about. So the job of NED in its grants program is to find Democrats, small D Democrats, and help them achieve their vision. And the way that's done is to look at all spheres of political and social life, people working on all the rights that Mark just mentioned, that includes independent media, of course, also free elections, also a vibrant civil society that's able to bring forth public policy questions for open debate. These groups that are working on this from the non-governmental side are the ones that NED has supported, and they always are changing their vision and are adapting to the current situation. So this is not a top-down vision about how an American institution can promote democracy one size fits all. Rather, each country needs to find its own path, and helping those people, extending a hand of friendship to help people build their own democracy is the core of the way that NED does its work.
And the challenges, though?
And the challenges. It's all a challenge. It's not easy to build a democracy, and it's also not easy to hold on to it. As we've seen, particularly new democracies are vulnerable to backsliding. And while the third wave of democratization was going on, starting actually in the 1970s, but really picking up steam in the 80s when Taiwan and also regional neighbor South Korea successfully launched their democracies, and certainly into the 90s with the end of the Soviet Union's and the dissolution of that authoritarian empire, democracy was on the march. The international conditions were favorable for local groups to help their entire society and all the political forces come together and at least establish the democracy. We are having a reverse wave, I strongly believe, and this means that the international conditions are not favorable. The standards are not there, the assistance is not as strong, and the confidence is on the side of the resurgent authoritarians. How to help people persist, sometimes survival is success, and in fact to resist backsliding and to build a new social contract in societies that are coming from war and internal conflict. These are huge challenges that Democrats and those societies have to face, and AD and its support always have to adapt and help them find new strategies.
I'm just, all the while, I'm trying, still connecting with our third speaker, but Mark, I'd like to go back to you. I think what Louisa brought up earlier about, you know, the sort of the phases of the resurgent, the march of democracy, and now there's sort of reverse that she described, is that, although I did not mention this in my opening remarks, it's that, you know, as the world's strongest democracy, the United States has played a pivotal role in democracy assistance. And that leadership, however, sort of has waxed and waned in people's perceptions and between administrations. So can you perhaps provide us with, you know, really a standard by which, you know, what is the U.S. policy on democracy promotion? What function has it played in U.S. policy more generally, in particular towards Asia? To me, the question of value of democracy, of promoting democracy, seems to always get stuck on why. Quote, because it serves U.S. strategic interests or objectives, and we don't get to the how. And I think as a proponent of democracy promotion, how do we get democracy promotion right?
Well, the if and the how questions are exactly the key. And in fact, we're at a moment now where there's not only some problems about corrosion of our own democracy, but the idea that the United States should be behind democracy assistance is not in vogue with this president. But the Reagan era was an era in which a bipartisan consensus on how U.S. interests and the values of democracy were tied together and emerged. It was a time where, in the height of the Cold War, it turned out to be its last chapter, the Reagan administration encouraged Taiwan, South Korea, and the Philippines in the direction of democracy because of that alignment of interests and values. And NED is special not because it's a Reagan invention, but because it's a bipartisan area of consensus. Now on the House, and Josh hopefully will be able to join us, he's written a book about some of the perils of implementation of democracy assistance policy. Here I just want to note a recent book. My colleague and friend Elliot Abrams has come out with a book, Realism and a Democracy, from the Council on Foreign Relations. And there he really strongly emphasizes political parties and assisting Democrats, multi-Democrats, to bring about democracy, and then you need people who will be politicians of parties. But he questions whether the democracy industry should focus so much on civil society. I think civil society really matters. One last point. Models matter. It matters. It matters that...
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
You just caught Mark right in the middle of what he was saying, but we're really happy to have you on, despite... No. There's always some technical difficulties here, but we managed, and so I'm glad to have you here. Mark right now is addressing on U.S. Policy towards democracy promotion, and eventually I'll get you in on the next question, all right?
Just to finish my thought, I think it's important for the United States not only to stand up for those who are under siege, but for it to assist in a process of nations being held up as models. It was an important thing that Indonesia, in a Muslim-majority country, went strongly in the direction of democracy, and there are eddies and problems today. But that example is important, and so too, U.S. signs of commitment working with Taiwan properly raise up a model. It's not for nothing that Burma looked to Taiwan. And then, of course, there are problems of backsliding in Burma. We're not paying attention to the model enough. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And that's a great segue, too. Thanks, Mark. Josh, I want to go to you next. And this is, I'm glad that you we were able to connect when we did. It's totally fine. Let's narrow the scope a bit because we've looked at the big picture. We look at how democracy was on the march in the 70s, 80s, but now according to Louisa, there seems to be a reverse wave. But I want to sort of take a deeper look. Josh, your expertise is on Southeast Asia, a region filled with rapidly growing economies of varying sizes, but also very politically diverse region. What do you see as the political trend line there, and how are democracies and fledgling democracies faring?
Well, I'd say other than Indonesia, which has got its own problems, and to some extent Singapore, which is sort of a semi-democracy. So in Southeast Asia, the democratic advance was really in the 90s and the early 2000s, and it's since the late 2000s, the region has gone backwards. And now, in the last 2 or 3 years, it's gone really, really far backwards. And so the situation is quite, quite dire. You went from a sort of semi-democratic regime government with problems in Thailand to a military coup. You went from a kind of rough pseudo-authoritarianism in Cambodia to really an outright dictatorship. You have what's going on in Myanmar. You have in Malaysia really a very problematic government cracking down on the opposition. You have in the Philippines an elected leader who was genuinely elected in a free election, but he has aggressively undermined the rule of law and overseen executions, and we know all this. And even in Indonesia, which is really the strongest democracy in the region, there's a great amount of tension between sort of democracy at the ballot box and the other institutions of democracy there that would preserve the courts and the rule of law and Indonesia's secular system. So I would say that this is the, without getting into the other stages, some of which are very extremely authoritarian, I would say this is the worst time for democracy in Southeast Asia in at least 15 years. It does not look likely to get better anytime soon. That doesn't mean that there isn't a role for outside actors, the US, Taiwan, Australia, Japan, and others, but it's quite dire.
Well, Josh, I want to stick with you here. You wrote, Mark mentioned also, you wrote two books that speaks directly to the subject matter at hand that we're talking about today. One is The Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, and the second one is Democracy in Retreat. In the former, you captured how Beijing was sort of wielding its soft power in the beginning of the 21st century and raising its influence. In the latter, you argued how China's rise could actually hinder democracy. And so, indeed, China's influence is growing, but it is not necessarily through soft power now, one would argue. How is Beijing's influence growing now? And I invite the other panelists also to weigh in on this after Josh. And how does China's rise actually hinder democracies?
Well, certainly in Southeast Asia, it's been a huge factor. I mean, we could debate whether it has been in some other parts of the world. I mean, I think that in the 19th Party Congress, the president made it clear that he, you know, in a very different way than a lot of other previous Chinese leaders who hinted at this, he made it clear that he sees China as a global model, and he's gonna stick to that and aggressively promote it. But so in Southeast Asia, initially what I was talking about was that China was sort of training Southeast Asian officials and spending a lot of money sort of showing them sort of the China model in a nascent way. Now in the last 5 to 10 years, you've had on top of that massive aid and diplomatic support and other programs for Southeast Asia, including the China's own version of essentially their southbound policy, which involves the Belt and Road Project and many other things to bring Southeast Asian nations into their fold. And there's no doubt that China's aid in places like Cambodia and maybe Myanmar and Thailand and the rhetorical support has played a significant role in those countries' leaders basically being able to bump their nose at Western donors, Western aid organizations, Western democracy promotion. Let's not say Western, but developed nations democracy promotion organizations. I think this situation is happening in the Philippines as well. And then what China has also been quite successful in doing is dividing the countries in the region in any sort of within their regional organization on a whole range of issues, including South China Sea, Taiwan, and others. But one of the issues they provide them on is basically that organization, ASEAN, which was never that interested in rights and democracy, has become completely uninterested. So in Southeast Asia, maybe not in other regions of the world, China is a major, major actor in undermining democracy.
Everybody,
yes,
if you want to comment on democracy and China.
Yes, just as democracies should serve as models for other countries, in fact, the authoritarian model is dangerous not only in the case of China, where other authoritarian rulers would love to have the wealth and the concentration of power, rather than thinking that a developed economy goes hand in hand with a liberal democratic system. Rather, China was able to show consistently now over 3 decades that a single party rule can go hand in hand with very rapid growth. At the same time, there's specific learning about authoritarian techniques of repression that I want to just point to. We know that China was a pioneer in being able to have a closed internet, that is an intranet within the country. Plenty of other countries saw that this could be done and invested in the technology to censor the new medium of social media, and not only to use it for surveillance, but then to set up a rather frightening new world of surveillance. And that includes what we've read about with facial recognition, cameras set up on street corners, combined with tracking through cell phones, combined with forced downloading of certain apps on the phones, for example, in China. And now we have the DNA collection, 40 million pieces of data somehow, whatever that means. And now the latest Human Rights Watch report on Monday talked about using voice recognition as another part of the database. Are these simply China's way of doing things? Of course other leaders and rulers can use this as a model. The techniques being developed by a resurgent authoritarian regime are not going to be confined within the borders of that country. And they're there for the taking for any other ruler with the same ambition.
Could I just add to that or that?
Yeah, sure, go ahead, Josh, please.
I think one thing that's important to add maybe, so what Luis is saying is, not only is it the idea that China has been successful in this, that they still seem to, we can debate this, but you know, they seem to enjoy some degree of domestic legitimacy while whatever their flaws, you know, overseeing a massive reduction in poverty, et cetera, we all know all that. But those specific tools that Luisa is talking about are actually being transferred to other countries. Other countries are aggressively seeking to learn about that technology. Vietnam, Thai leaders, Malaysian leaders. I don't know about Cambodians, but it wouldn't be surprised, countries in the Middle East. So it's not only the model of how China's done it, but the specific technological advances and a kind of new Orwellianism that they've achieved that other countries want to come learn about and then bring them home and adapt it to their environment.
I just, very eloquent statement about China's influence in the region and methods of authoritarianism being spread. I just note the kind of connection between global power politics and governance. So the United States is a model. The bloom kind of came off the rose with the financial crisis meltdown in 2008. And so this notion that if you want to be economically successful, then you might want to have a new political order kind of blemish. Blemishes are being added today by Western democracies, populist leaders. The United States should worry about ways in which there's an ecosystem of liberalism that it should protect. And so I think it's actually bad for democracy for the United States to pull back from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and in essence hand the baton to China. And the Burma case is very, very interesting. It is said that the opening with Burma, with the United States, had something to do with Burma's government being concerned about the looming presence of China. And so, in that sense, you know, we should look at where power and politics come together and try and encourage those towards the democratic model. Let me say, you know, for those who are concerned about the United States as a model, my smart wife, a political scientist, says, if you're going to do the time, you might as well do the crime. If the United States is going to be about promoting democracy, or a model that should do so forthrightly. I'm not sure what that is.
Thank you for that, Mark. You know, moving back to you, Luisa, and as the GTI, our focus here is on Taiwan. And so, you know, Carl Gershman, your former boss and friend, the president of the National Endowment for Democracy, had a significant role in the founding of the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, the first national democracy assistance foundation in Asia. What do you think was the rationale at the time encouraging Taiwan to establish the TFD? And can you share with your observation about how the organization has evolved over the years?
I hope you'll call on yourself, Russell. You're the only one here on this panel who's actually worked at the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. I think that's where we first met.
That's the moderator.
Yeah. Yeah, about 10 years ago. You served 2 years there. It would be great if you can chime in. Certainly, in the period of the third wave of democratization, it was, even though international conditions were very favorable to strong promotion of a liberal international order that included liberal democratic nation states within it, nonetheless, takes work to bring about democracy. And so part of what the Taiwanese government could see was it could be a partner in a global effort. Taiwan, of course, is very isolated, and so every effort there is for the government of Taiwan and the government representing the people to be part of a positive international effort is always good for Taiwan, and of course was good for democracy. And democracy is a universal ideal. So for an American institution like NIT to say there should be other partners around the world helps clearly illustrate that this is nothing being imposed by Western countries, but rather there are people in every society looking to implement this universal ideal that the people should be in charge of their own destiny. And interestingly, the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy actually has a dual mission, strengthening democracy at home and also abroad. This follows the model of the German political foundations, which were established on the ashes of terrible authoritarian disaster in World War II. And each party in that case had a political foundation that both educated Germans about civic values and partnered with others abroad to do the same thing. Taiwan has about half, TFD has about half of its mission directed towards strengthening democracy in Taiwan. And I just want to say one of the reasons why that's so important is that it goes right to the heart of what I believe is one of Taiwan's greatest strategic assets, which is not its ability to defend itself, although its defense and economic ties around the world are so important to its strength. Its strength as a nation comes from having successfully become a democracy. Here's my illustration. Do a thought experiment. If you have the KMT and the CCP, both authoritarian one-party states, marching along, suddenly China, the Communist Party of China, opens up to international trade and starts getting rich and having a large market. In comparison, Taiwan's market, although incredibly impressive still, and in fact a very major trading partner of all the major economies, nonetheless is smaller by comparison. And we know how the China market is like a magnet. It's mesmerizing to governments and private sector around the world. Suppose they had both remained authoritarian, and you have a gigantic market of 1.2 billion people and a comparatively smaller market of 23 million people, and the larger of the two powers is constantly pressuring every government and private sector to choose between. What is there to choose from? Because Taiwan, however, is a democracy, now there is something to choose from. This is key to Taiwan's survival and the well-being of its people. And so strengthening Taiwan's democracy and being known for standing up for democracy, I believe, is an existential strategic asset for the entire Taiwanese people.
Yeah, having worked there, I would just say that, the point about how integral democracy is for the survival of Taiwan is a point that should not be lost in both the fact of how democracy has helped support Taiwan's existence as it is now, to now being able to provide that benefit for how, for other societies to be able to make similar transitions to a more freer and open society is, I think a logical outgrowth of Taiwan's own struggle to maintain its system, and in that way, providing a more fertile environment where democracy flourishes is essential for being able to provide an environment where Taiwan continues to flourish as well, as you rightly pointed out, Lisa. Okay, so I'd like to move quickly now to the communal questions and contextualizing a lot of our discussions here on more sort of broader policy efforts that are undertaken both in Taipei and Washington. And the first question is that A major policy initiative of the current Taiwan government is a new southbound policy. Now, at the recent USEN forum that was held in Taipei earlier this month, which saw the gathering of many former leaders from across the region, including former AIT chairman Ray Burkhardt, U.S. ambassador to Burma Derek Mitchell. In there, one thing that stood out really is to me was that the former Thai foreign minister, Kasit Priyoma, who served as from 2008 to 2011, stated that besides economic cooperation and people-to-people ties, Taiwan could share its democratization experience with Southeast Asia. So my question is pretty straightforward. Is what advice can you offer on how Taiwan can best share that experience to help other countries in the region to with their own political transition process? And perhaps I'll have Louisa go first, and then Mark, and then Josh.
Sounds good.
The most recently announced components of the policy are right on track. Academic and educational exchange, this is a huge strength in Taiwan. It's a large place with Chinese-speaking dominant media and population and publishing that is free, and so it provides, again, a center of creation of free inquiry, not only as a model for other countries, but certainly even for China, that this is being created out of a neighboring place. And so for Taiwan to have academic exchanges with people in Southeast Asia, who places where in fact Chinese is spoken in some circles, the spirit of free inquiry, the vibrant civil society that is really on a roll now, it's really dramatically different than even 10 years ago, I would say, a very active civil society with the Sunflower Movement, but far beyond that, all kinds of social and public policy issues that require active involvement of citizens and interest groups, and then active youth movement, right? So if we look to the future, the more that the people-to-people exchanges and the educational exchanges can emphasize the people who are going to be shaping the future of their countries, the better off, the more successful that policy will be in drawing the attention of the future leaders of those societies to the benefits of a democratic system. Can I ask give one cautionary note, though? So a major component, of course, of the southbound policy is increased trade ties. And naturally, this is a glue for ties and for Taiwan's international space, of course. And yet, at the same time, Taiwanese private sector should watch out for its reputation. If Taiwanese ownership of manufacturing and trade practices do not reflect the liberal values that are part of its democratic system, it's seen as no better than the factory bosses from an authoritarian country like, let's say, in Vietnam, or Chinese-owned outbound investment or direct foreign investment, then the difference disappears. So this is something that I think civil society and legislators and the government should work on, is to do their utmost to ensure that Taiwanese economic behavior reflects those liberal values as well, so as not to undermine the rest of the policy.
What Louisa talks about are not only channels for communication, but aspects of the model to share. Civil society being vital and being important to the transformation of the political order in Taiwan since the early 1990s, youth as well. Let's drill down. What are the aspects of the model? It would be good for Taiwan to really drive home what are the aspects of the model. And let's the transformation of a government in which there is a dominant party, the transformation of a party, and from a military component of rule, and then there is a significant issue of corruption. And the sort of interlocking nature of political parties and industrial entities. And there, the KMT has had serious problems and has reformed itself some and has farther to go. And of course, in the maturation of the DPP, and there's a reason I'm wearing a green tie today, it's in its second time in power, and this time with a legislative majority. It's lifting itself up from accusations of corruption associated with the Chun presidency, And you know, it has a lot to share as long as it is candid about you know where it's moved from or moving from.
Josh?
Well, I'm rather than talking about the parties in Taiwan or some of these other broader issues, I think it's valuable to address some of the really major challenges, frankly, to the southbound policy. And the difficulty that Taiwan, even on the non-governmental track, which obviously isn't the governmental track, is going to have in assessing how Southeast Asian countries are going to respond, and also the elephant, the whatever you want to call it, the panda in the room, which is that Beijing is already taking huge strides to block a number of southbound policy efforts in key countries, particularly in Thailand, but also in other countries. And the third thing, which is that I'm afraid that the southbound policy has to reckon with the fact that in some of these countries, Thailand, and I would say also increasingly Cambodia and to some extent the Philippines, China is a lot more popular than it was in the past. So again, I'm not trying to be negative, I'm just saying that the obstacles are very high. So I think that the first thing is simply to, for the southbound policy, simply to find interlocutors who can be who either are still confident that it can't be shut down by Beijing, or who exist and are strong enough domestically that they're willing to work with Taiwan on some of these critical issues. I'm not even sure that there are that many of those interlocutors remaining outside of the education sphere in Thailand, but I think you're going to have to work really hard to identify them in Cambodia as well. I think that all the discussion of the model, the methodology, is fine, but actually when it represents the road on the ground in a lot of these countries, it's going to be very, very challenging. And I think that the first step really needs to be defined. I mean, in Thailand, civil society has been utterly decimated in the last 3 years. So in order to work with even educational partners, we're willing to risk not only the military government's ire, but also China's, it's going to be very challenging. So I think that first step is, I'm sorry to be more of like a granular type person, but I think the first step is really to like figure out what space is even possible, because what you also don't want, right, that some people, like some academics who are involved in the educational exchanges wind up being arrested, right? Like academics were involved in promoting a forum in Chiang Mai a few months ago, really just to discuss Thai politics, etc. They were arrested. Having nothing to do with Taiwan, right? In some of the countries in the region, there's more room, obviously. But I think that really needs to be the first assessment, is to try to find what interlocutors actually have legitimacy and can't be intimidated by Beijing, and also are able to work together closely. I know that you guys have been working on that, but I think from the Southeast Asian side, it's extremely precarious. The second thing is, in terms of the quote-unquote model, is that I think that works really well with certain civil society and parliamentarians, but the next step is to convince local businesses in these countries who can be an effective force, and then also even some government officials who have a chance of actually holding office at some point, and that step is also very challenging. So again, sorry to be like the granular reporting guy, but I think that those hurdles really need to be proven able to overcome first.
Yeah, no, thanks, Josh. You know, your new title is the Grim of GTI now. Thank you for that for a sobering assessment. I think it's very important to be able to identify what the obstacles will be and the challenges, so that you know, so that any efforts to undertake can take that will take that into account to have a realistic approach to achieving the objectives of the policy. I think for the interest of time, also I'll combine last two sort of communal questions that I have, and so that there'll be an opportunity for some questions from the audience. which I'd like to provide about 15 minutes or so. So the questions are similar in the sense that in 2004, there were two scholars who have penned this op-ed in the Washington Post calling for a concert of democracy. This is Evo Dalliter and Don Lindsay. And Senator McCain picked up on this idea in his 2008 presidential run. Yet past efforts have floundered in the face of disagreements among democracies over the necessity, intent. There were concerns that coalition would not be effective because it excluded powerful countries such as China and Russia, who are now using its growing influence to achieve its political objectives. I've heard conditions for that made those counter-arguments for this initiative have changed considerably. The first question is the time right for the call for a new League of Democracies? And related to that question also is that a recent foreign affairs article is written by a European scholar argued that to respond to this era of authoritarian influence, end quote, deterring authoritarian governments like China and Russia and influence liberal democracies won't work. That threats of retaliation are unrealistic and inappropriate. Instead, democracy should promote transparency requirements, regulations, and public awareness. Are those measures sufficient? How can Taiwan contribute in those efforts? Again, let's maybe perhaps we'll follow the same line that we had last time with Louisa first, Mark, and then Josh.
The intergovernmental and non-governmental institutions that made up the liberal world order that we've enjoyed since World War II, at least that was the goal, common goal of the democracies. Now we know how important even seemingly marginal efforts were. So you might think about the UN. Did the UN bring about its goals of peaceful, prosperous world? No, it did not. But now that we see the authoritarian governments more and more assertively, aggressively, and confidently undermining even some of the talk shops in the human rights system, even in some of the specialized areas, telecoms, and how Interpol works, not part of the UN system, but an intergovernmental organization, it's become quite clear that even when these bodies don't achieve their goals 100%, are not able to live up to their ideals, nonetheless, it's better when the great weight of the important large countries is behind those goals and at least has to play lip service to them. And we see more and more the more confident authoritarian regimes, particularly China and Russia, feeling confident about undermining those forums. Of course, also creating alternatives like the Belt and Road Initiative, the Shanghai Cooperation Organizations, using some of the institutions of the international order, such as intergovernmental organizations registering with the UN and becoming having a certain kind of legitimacy as treaty organizations, and yet at the same time, the purpose of those is to undermine the premises of an international liberal order. And so clearly the first thing to do, whether it's a formally named concert or not, recognize the threat and recommit to those institutions which do exist and can be saved.
So I actually have used Jim Lindsay's and Evo Dalliter's piece in teaching at Georgetown. I asked the question, were they right when they wrote it, and are they right today? So I think they are right that democracies should band together. And it's true for the East Asian scene. But some questions are worth asking. League of Democracies was a proposal because it was a subset of the overall community of democracies. High capacity democracies. Is that the better route? Is there a suitable entity of democracies for the East Asian region? The experience in the United Nations or of the community of democracies indicates that global South democracies are sometimes resistant to be bold when it comes to democratic values in their neighbors. So it's worth asking those questions. On the question about whether it's wisest to focus on transparency and regulations and public awareness, I don't think that's sufficient. It's good, but I don't think it's sufficient. I don't think we should come to the conclusion, well, you know, democracy is out of vogue, it's the wilderness years, let's think about the nuts and bolts issues of governance and openness. Those things are important, but it is worth being bolder. And this is one of the reasons why U.S. government communications in support of democracy is important. Radio Free Asia is, you know, remains a good idea 20 years into its life to help supplement where there isn't.
Joshua?
Yeah, I mean, I think Community of Democracies, Global Polydemocracy Forum, works well, or works most effectively. First of all, yeah, I think the idea was a good idea. Works most effectively when prominent developing countries who have been successful examples of democratization. So that would include Taiwan, although Taiwan is often excluded from international organizations, but when prominent developing countries are able to take the lead. So with the Bali Democracy Forum, President Yono in Indonesia for a while took the lead, and I'm not saying that that was a roaring success, but it's probably perceived more effectively by other developing nations than communities of democracy idea, in which major developed and large democracies lead. I think it's a good idea. You know, I think that more value could be placed on other. So now we have in this situation, which is sort of like an emergency situation, where, you know, I mean, we have really serious threats to democracy, and we're not really sure what this administration is going to do. So I think that the key now is, rather than setting up some sort of forum, new forum, but having other actors who have the clarity and the resources to step up to the plate. And on a bilateral basis, make commitments to, A, rhetorically step in and say, you know, very clearly, we're going to assume the role, some of the role of promoting democracy, which we think is really important to our, you know, core values. So that would, and that we're going to put the money up for it because we think it's important, and we think it's important for security, and we think it's also important just for, you know, fundamental human rights. So that would include Germany, it would include a step that was made by the EU, include Canada, it could include Taiwan. I don't think it's likely under Prime Minister Abe, but it's possible that it could include Japan. I think we're in an emergency situation, and those actors have a role to play. But I have nothing against the idea of a community of democracies as a valuable place to, you know, share histories and share best practices.
Right. And I would just add as a final point to Josh's observation about the role of how different democracies can work together, that the Secretary of State Tillerson made a, I think, pretty important speech just last week over at CSIS, where he highlighted how Indo-Pacific democracies could work together to contribute more to secure the security in the Indo-Pacific region. And he highlighted India, and he highlighted Japan, and he also included Australia there. And I think, you know, despite, I think, the sort of delay in the current administration sort of vocalizing support for democracies, we may be at a turn where there seems to be some recognition of the importance of democracies and shared values in the role in U.S. foreign policy. So I know that we were going over time, but we'd like to get some questions in from the audience. And so I'd like to please state your name, affiliation, and please direct your question to one of the speakers. So, you know, state who you're speaking to, since Josh is not here. The gentleman in the back, please.
I'm Steve Winters, independent consultant. I try to make this brief. Could the two speakers who are here comment on their view of the relationship between independence movements and democracy, particularly among the youth? We have an umbrella movement and similar things in Taiwan. Where are you going to draw the line there, or is that full speed ahead?
Collecting questions?
Well, I think we can pick right now the questions, and then we'll be a lot of time and then get close to the end.
Protocol is you first.
Okay. I don't know of any movements that you mentioned are not democracy, not independence movements. Put that on the record. In both cases, the major points of consensus had to do with living up, in fact, to principles of self-government under liberal rules. So I consider those two movements as democracy movements, full stop.
I think if we get into the business of telling what small T Democrats need to think and say, it's problematic. We can have tactical discussion, but ultimately they have to speak for themselves. I'm vexed as someone I've come to know, Joshua Wong, who has been threatened in the legal system in Hong Kong for his new party speaking its mind. But, small D Democrats have to choose their own tactics.
Professor Shi, the second row.
Fang Longxu, I'm from London School of Economic and Political Science. So follow the same question. When we're thinking about Taiwan, the rule, and the democratization, and the authoritarian the influence, I think this is our concern. We will ask if Taiwan should campaign for the Taiwan independence while campaigning with the democracy. Independence make a democracy more solid in the case of the U.S. However, under the PRC authoritarian influence, will this still be the case for Taiwan and Hong Kong?
All right, I'll just try to be brief and say something about Taiwan. My advice for how best to contribute to democratization and at the same time strengthen prospects for a good future for the people of Taiwan is in fact to play to Taiwan's strengths. And of course, one of the points of weakness for Taiwan is it's totally isolated in a very unjustifiable way, a large country, 23 million people, so unreasonably shut out of many international forums where in fact a country can make a contribution because of China, and this is all because of China's authoritarian intimidation. But because it's wrong doesn't mean it's not out there, and so my advice is Taiwan should play to its strength, as in the case of a free Chinese language sphere of academic freedom and free inquiry, as in the case of being in fact turning a weakness into a strength. Taiwan is the target of much of China's external soft power. It really should be, it's dirty power, right? Trying to manipulate social media, influence public opinion in a non-transparent way in other countries. All the things we as Americans are worried about in our own political debates and electoral campaigns. A lot of that is happening in Taiwan. Taiwan is the point of the spear for that. I think Taiwan should, there should be more investment in understanding it. Taiwan Sentinel, as an English language newspaper, covers this a lot. Understand it, expose it, and develop counter strategies. In this way, Taiwan can actually contribute to this other countries defending against this kind of unreasonable interference in their own domestic debates. It's another example of China playing to its strengths.
This is a way of kind of capturing a whole discussion here. While our buzzkill of the panel, Josh, asks questions about how the model can be spread in the region and how dire the situation is, particularly in Southeast Asia, worse than in 15 years, it remains the case that Taiwan is very much a model that is valuable to countries trying to transition and to those in civil society trying to transition their countries. I agree entirely with Louisa that it is very important for Taiwan to play to its strength. Identity is different from immediate independence, but in every respect, calling attention to its model creates space for it and an identity, because the fact is, Taiwan has been a separate land on its own path since 1949. And since the early 1990s, and particularly when Lee Dongwei was re-elected in the first full democratic election, he's a democratic.
Just one very quick add-in to that, which is, Lisa mentioned this, that Taiwan has a long history of being targeted by China in ways in which China uses overseas influence campaigns and other ways to try to directly involve itself in Taiwan's domestic politics, shape them, etc., essentially meddle in Taiwan's internal affairs. Now, in the past, I would say 5 years, and certainly going to ramp up under the president, under Xi Jinping's second term, China is taking a somewhat similar approach, which it tried out in Southeast Asia 10 years ago globally, in which it is directly trying to involve itself as a player in domestic politics in a whole wide range of countries, in a whole range of ways that are now coming to light, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, many others. So I think given that Taiwan has been dealing with this for decades, in addition to everything else I said, there's some valuable learning that we can learn specifically like by politicians in some of these states that are not prepared for this from Taiwan.
5 more minutes for questions. I'm going to bundle the questions. This gentleman, second row, and then this gentleman in the front, Mike, and then Louisa.
Thank you. I'm Francis. I'm a Hong Kong working in technology. I want to give a small point on the point on technique, because I want to highlight that up to very recently, lots of the technologies used by this repression regime, such as drones, censorship, keyword matching, as well as the usage of social media to influence elections, as well, of course, surveillance, as highlighted by Mr. Snowden, is actually pioneered in the Western world, so much as the United States. However, what I want to highlight is, despite this technology advance, the West, especially the United States, have not, to me, my feeble knowledge, seen to play a leading part in codifying the ethics as well as a good practice as an international treaty of all these new technologies. I mean, especially if I humbly say the United States have not seemed to be playing a very heavy part in joining a lot of international treaties. So I'm saying, is there a point on allowing the Western world, especially Taiwan, maybe in economic circles or regulatory regimes, maybe, to play a more heavier part in the regulation of these technologies so that it can be stood apart from usages by authoritarian regimes. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Michael Larkin with the Forum on International Affairs. This question, I guess, could go to Josh, because I think you had a book on this, but this involves models. I'll be interested to hear anyone's opinion on it. Why do we think the virtuous cycle of more economic growth and the appearance of a larger middle class in Southeast Asia so far is not having the effect of inculcating more respect for democratic values such as tolerance and so on and so forth, such as it did in Taiwan, since I think you could make a good case that economic growth there did have that virtuous cycle effect. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Louisa Chang. I'm a freelance consultant. I had the pleasure and honor of working with Louisa Grieva back in NED on China. So I have a quick comment, and then the questions are for all of the presenters. So as Louisa and I both know, that China, that actually there's a lot of fragility politically within China behind its international program of dirty power, to quote Louisa. That, for example, that Taiwan has actually been used by a lot of China's own civil society, the liberal opinion leaders in Chinese civil society, as an example of why China should liberalize. And so I would love to hear what commentators would, what you would say about how, again, that Taiwan and other liberal democracies can take advantage of this fragility. Thank you.
three questions. That first comment, and turned into a question, is whether or not there should be a code of ethics in new technology, the use of new technology for democratic, sort of means. Two is the, why hasn't, for Josh, which is for, why hasn't economic, growth led to greater political liberalization in Southeast Asia? And then third is, on the question of Taiwan, global democracy, and printing in this ability.
I'll just choose one, which is the one about the fragility. I think those who are working to support a liberal international order should use liberal means to do so, and so rather than speaking in terms of taking advantage, I would simply say, do the right thing. So along the lines of what you're suggesting, it's important to support people from China or those in exile, in Taiwan who are well-equipped to be analysts to expose when the government and the party are concealing their corruption, concealing conditions in the country, failing to fully report on conditions of pollution, although the government announced it was going to address itself to the people's grievances with pollution and standard of living and so on. Nonetheless, we know there's no free inquiry and ability to have truth be exposed. So I think telling the truth is the very first step.
On new technologies, I do think that there should be multilateral efforts to think about how they're misused for surveillance. It is important, however, in the way the internet is governed and cyber affairs are governed, not to create a process in which, in fact, the United States and China have a larger voice in moving things away from a liberal direction. Why hasn't there been more democratization and inculcation of attitude just coming with the middle class growing? Well, it's because, when Henry Rowan wrote a couple decades ago that there's this magic per capita GDP that when it's reached in China, suddenly democracy will appear. It doesn't quite work that way. It requires, building the different building blocks of pluralism. And so that's why civil society activity, international solidarity is important. And on fragility, I just would say, China looks like it's the colossus until it isn't. And there may be a moment in which it's, the biggest of economic bubbles you've ever seen pops. And so Taiwan stands there as an important model in how a one-party state can transition to something more realistic.
Josh?
Sure. Just one brief comment on what Mark just said. The problem partly about that China becomes so big, so influential in the world economy, et cetera, is that although we all want China and every country to democratize, I don't even know what would happen if China actually had a massive economic downturn. There would be so many issues to deal with in addition and feeling major shocks to the global economy. But in Southeast Asia, I think what you've had is something of a recitation of the traditional Huntington, other political scientists' idea that a certain achievement of a middle class is sort of a bedrock of democracy. It doesn't mean that it's not, but what's interceded is, one, in a number of those countries, the middle classes have gone from believing in all of the aspects of democracy, including the ballot box, to basically believing and supporting often kind of illiberal democracy, in which they're just so fired up to support only voting and for their partisans, and that anyone on the other side is wrong, and it's worthwhile to tear down aspects of the democratic system other than voting in order to destroy the other side. Now,
that sounds kind of familiar, by the way.
This sounds pretty familiar. It's starting to sound pretty familiar here now, in which institutions that were normally accepted as key to the democratization of the democracy itself have now become sort of thrust aside, institutions and norms, because all that matters is defeating the other side at the ballot box. Or even not at the ballot box, but at the ballot box. So that's number one. I would say number two, the middle class is in a number of the countries in the region. Some of them never completely shed. Well, they moved to democracy. There was never a full repudiation of the armed forces, a particular potential backup source of stability and centrality, something that you don't have in Taiwan and other really successful democracies like Chile. I mean, we could go through a whole list. And so as a result, with the armed forces never fully marginalized in Indonesia and the Philippines and Thailand, obviously, and Myanmar, that's a problem. And I have to say something. I'm worried about some things that I see in the United States in the way the armed forces is discussed now. So that's number two. And then the third thing is I think that the regional environment, I think the Obama administration was interested in promoting better relations with Southeast Asia, but didn't really do very much to promote consolidation of democracy. Pretty weak democracy policy in the Obama administration, and I think now that's been followed up by, I guess, what I think is going to be a complete utter absence of any democracy policy. So you have no real outside pressure from major powers either, and those things together are not a great combination.
All right, with that, please join me in thanking our panelists today. Plenty of events in November, so stay tuned for our updates. And if you're not already subscribed to receive our updates, please visit our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. Thank you.